Welcome to the Innovation in Healthcare podcast, produced by the Academic Health Science Network for the Northeast and North Cumbria, which supports innovation in all its forms within the NHS and social care. This podcast showcases some of the amazing work that we do to transform healthcare by driving the spread and adoption of innovation, both regionally and nationally. Dr. Joe Chidinika is our Programme Manager for the National Accelerated Access Collaborative and AHSN's Lipid and FH Programme. In this episode, Joe talks to our Cardiovascular Disease Programme Lead, Kate Mackay, about his passion for CVD, particularly when it comes to improving health inequalities. And he also highlights how his other passion for football helps him encourage better health and well-being across home turf.
Well, Joe, it's over to me and you now.
It is.
We don't often get a chance really to have a chat because work's usually so busy. And I know, you know, you're here with your lipids and FH National Programme Manager hat on and based within the Northeast and North Cumbria. But I know you from days of old in your public health role. And I know prior to that, you were in nursing. So I just wondered, what prompted you to get involved in healthcare?
Oh, yeah. It takes me back, actually, when we the way you've introduced our discussion, Kate, because I've known you from that previous life when I worked in public health and Teesside. So it's been many, many years, and, you know, it's great to still have that connection with, other topics which we worked on. But what prompted me to come into nursing and public health, it was probably opportunistic, because we've got a very strong family, which is medical and clinical, so to say. My mom, she retired when she was a senior matron in Zimbabwe, served for so many, I don't know, over 30, 40 years as a clinical nurse. My sister, who also is within the clinical background, she works for the United Nations now as one of the leads for sexual health, based in New York. But she had a funny kind of going into health, because she started off doing banking, then she went into to start work to university, Keele University, around genomics. So she had a degree in genomics, then ended up in sexual health. So that was kind of an inspiration for me to say, well, actually, you know, there's that career. My young brother is in Cardiff. He's also a nurse. But I wanted to be a doctor, but I just didn't make the grade in Zimbabwe, qualification-wise, and decided, well, I'll go into retail sector. So I worked as a sales executive for years. But my mom didn't want me to have a blue collar job. So she said she wanted me to change and go into health and follow my dreams about being a doctor. Long story short, I moved on to Teesside and did my nurse training. That was fulfilling, but I went straight into cardiothoracic care, where we did heart operations at James Cook. So it was really at the extreme end of secondary care prevention, which helped me realize what I really wanted to do was primary care, was prevention, public health. So I then moved in and did my qualifications, my master's in public health, my PhD, which I later did a few years ago, because I was so passionate about preventing illness. And yes, there's a place for secondary care, but I just thought, well, as they say, prevention is better than cure. So it has been a winding road. I just didn't set out to be in the nursing fraternity or in the clinical field. But yeah, that's my journey, so to say, Kate.
Wow. Your mum sounds like a very charismatic woman.
She was. She was very inspiring. But again, totally different work stream backgrounds from my dad, who was a lawyer, or was into the legal side of things. And he wanted, my dad wanted me to be more practical. So I did diesel mechanics for a year and a half. halfway through, again, they all decided that, no, I shouldn't do that. So I had to change, like I said, went into sales. But she was, my mom was very inspirational. She said, whatever you want to do, focus on it. You can achieve, the highest qualifications you get in that field. But it then so happened that she had that affinity, and I could say a compassion, not just from home, but how she cared in the community, how she was passionate about cardiovascular disease, actually, as a specialist nurse there. So she did drive us and got me to university, pushed me through my master's to do it. And then one day she said, you will be a doctor. So I think she's got something to do with my PhD.
I mean, there's different forms of being a doctor, and thinking about your PhD, to do a PhD takes a massive amount of commitment, as everybody knows. What was it about, what motivated you to do that, really, and to commit to that?
Yeah, it was after I did my master's, and to be fair, at that point, in public health, you remember the days of PCTs, then public health moved into local authorities. The roles there, I was like, started off as a health improvement specialist. There's no prerequisite to have a master's qualification, but it was a desirable qualification. And I remember many of my colleagues didn't have the time to do it. And I think if brighter people than me don't have time to do it, I surely cannot. But I think the mindset changed when I was really focusing on the prevention agenda. I needed to know more. I needed to read it for myself. So I got the chance to be sponsored and did my master's. Then I remember when I finished my master's, one of the tutors there said, oh, you had a very good grade in public health. Yeah, ideal candidate to do your PhD. But then I remember having the discussion with my line manager and said, actually, Joe, many people say this, you do not need to have a PhD qualification to do what you're doing. But from the knowledge thirst you've got in this subject area, it will do you a world of good if you go for it. And I said, oh, I didn't want to. I felt pushed as well, not only from my mom, but from my manager. And we said, well, you've got to do this. And to be fair, many people sponsor themselves. But I was so lucky to work in an organization. They say, we will pay for your PhD. Go and do it. And, no strings attached. You don't have to work for us after that. As long as you're in the public health, you contribute. So that was so inspiring. And I remember speaking to Professor Peter Kelly, if you remember.
Oh, yeah. I remember. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I sat with him and he asked me, what's your aspiration? What do you want to do? He's got a PhD as well. And he was so practical about the opportunities that brings, not only from a financial side, but really from an impact, do something that will impact the population. So I'll never forget that when I sat with Peter Kelly and he was open and said, well, go for it. But again, life comes in the way. I've got two young kids. You've got a partner who's also aspiring, who's doing their stuff. And you just think, well, this is not for me, But I opted to do the doctorate, which is a five-year course, thought course. So it wasn't a push as a PhD where you have to do it in 3 years. So I did find that balance quite helpful in a way. But again, I have to emphasize, in my role, even in my current role, a PhD or that qualification is not a prerequisite. So it was only, I did it for my own personal development. I also did it for me to just to know that I can actually learn at that level more than anything else.
Did you ever, when you were, 5 years is a long time and a big commitment. Were there any times along the way where you were tempted to give up?
Actually, yes. And this goes quite personal, to be honest. I think in my second last year, when you had to really start doing your thesis, my dad was very poorly in Zimbabwe. And you'd appreciate if you're so far away, nothing else matters. And I remember visiting him down in Zimbabwe and he was so unwell. And I was quite behind with my thesis then because I'd done my field research, I'd done my analysis, thematic analysis, and I was ready to start writing the thesis, so to say. But then it put everything into perspective when he was not well. And I'm thinking, I'm worried about this, education and stuff. But what was helpful then, he recovered well. I was happy that I was on his side. Probably going there with my brother helped him to recover. Then he turned around and said, I'm well now. You go back and finish your PhD. Because he knew that I'd deferred my thesis then. So it was another kick kicking the right direction to say, I've got to go and do it. So yeah. It was painful. It was quite long. And, you know, just the thought of actually submitting your PhD, then actually defending it through a viva, what they call viva voce, or, you know, kind of a face-to-face exam, really was off-putting. But when I was close, when I submitted it, I felt I wanted to defend it. I wanted to prove that I know what I'm talking about. I'm not an authority in that field, but at PhD level, that's what you need to be showing.
You know what I'm going to ask you next, though, don't you, Joe? Okay. What was your thesis on?
Okay. It was a mixture. You know my affinity with cardiovascular disease. So it was mixture of that, but also I was the lead in TSIDE for suicide prevention and mental health. So when you look through a thesis to have something authentic, you've got to come up with a topic which is probably not many people have researched on, but something which combines some elements of uniqueness. So my thesis, if I remember well, I should have brought this up. It was around exploration of mental health service users' perspective of social marketing in relation to stigma. But it was really looking at people with mental health illness. How does that stop them accessing physical health interventions, and in particular cardiovascular disease? Because what I found was that for people who have got mental health illness, as you would know, they die prematurely, not because of anything else, but because they've got a mental illness and they're not accessing the services they need to access readily. But then put long-term illnesses like cardiovascular disease, which reduces life expectancy. So rather than just dying 20 years younger because you got mental illness, if you got mental illness and cardiovascular disease, as an example, you probably die 30 years younger. So yeah. I just found that very unfair, very unequal, and I needed to bring forth something that really defends the parity of esteem between mental health and physical health. And it so happened it was those two topics I've worked on. So that was my thesis on. So it was really looking at how do we use social marketing to improve their access to services, because it is, in my thesis, well, the big thing which came out was that having a mental health diagnosis was even worse than any other condition. You get just the label of mental illness. So it was something to do with stigma. And then when you look at, say, Mahmoud, who talks about proportionate universalism, that is the very ethos of what we need to be doing. Those people who are so disadvantaged, who die early, who we know who they are, we need to reach out for them. So, yeah, that is the passion that brought me to do my that topic area in my thesis.
I think, you know, because I know health inequalities is one of your sort of passionate topics and something that you're very interested in. And with your involvement in public health, with your thesis, you know, and it's very topical at the moment, there's a lot more emphasis on tackling health inequalities, perhaps than there ever has been in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels a lot more like there's some real robustness behind it than perhaps there has been in the past, and a more strategic view of it, and a more... there's more to it perhaps than there has been in the past. So in terms of sort of health inequalities and obviously with CVD and all of that side of things, where do you see that in terms of the lipid program and the FH program, how that all fits in together?
It's a good thing, because it's not only is it topical, but we all agree that COVID has actually shone the light on health inequalities. But again, I'll go back to my passion around social injustice. And this is nothing other than the biggest motivator to me to really, in any topic area I've worked, to make sure that people know what's out there. People know the statistics. But actually behind those statistics, there's people there whose families have been changed because of not accessing the right medication at the right time. And that's what I think our national program for lipids and FH actually brings forth, to say we've got a problem here. I remember some quotations last year to say, yes, COVID has killed over 150,000 people, which is a huge number of people who, some of them needlessly didn't need to you know, to lose their life, but because of the pandemic, because of the health inequalities, they lost their lives. But having said that, in that same space of time or within a year, we lost about 160,000 people to CVD alone. So you can see the impact of cardiovascular disease. It is the biggest killer. One in four people will have vascular dementia, for example. But we know that vascular dementia is linked to poor cardiovascular outcomes. So if we improve cardiovascular outcomes, we reduce the other issues like dementia. But we also know that about 28% of the population, I might be wrong here, 28% of the people in the UK are obese. So then, you know, we need to be working on the interaction between physical health and physical activity. But 39% of adults actually as well are not doing the recommended physical activity guidelines that we know we should be sticking to. So that on its own, you can just see the effort that is there outside just what we talk about, the interventions for the lipid program. There's a whole host of public health initiatives that can actually aid us in there. We focus on the pathway because it's a treatment pathway, but beyond that, there's so many things which we always need to be aware of. But I do know that as well, in the Northeast, for example, about 47% of our 25 to 44 year olds die from heart and circulatory diseases every year as compared to those people in the South. So again, there's that health inequality, but there's also even those people in the South who might have better health, there's pockets of areas of deprivation where still we need to proportionally be targeting. I remember talking to Dermot Neely when I started this post, and they're saying, well, the guidance of NICE were published in 2009, the original guidance. And here we are in 2022. So talking about how do we implement this guidance? So everything, you know, over the years we've done has contributed to better outcomes, but we're still a long way, over 10, 15 years of that. So to me, there's that push about health inequalities, there's that push about social injustice, but there's also that push to equip our clinicians who are at the forefront of this program to have that choice to say, well, we've got a patient in front of us, we've found the right patient, what are the options of treatment which are there? So my role and the national team is not necessarily to prescribe, to say, let's increase this uptake of this very good drug, whether it's high-intensity statins or anything within the pathway. It is to say, it is your own judgment. This is the pathway. If we need to work with your area, whether it's at an ICS level or PCN level, to see how you can adapt the national guidance to work for you locally, that's our role. And I think we've seen a sea change since we started in October 2020 in the uptake of not just particular drugs, but actually areas who are saying we understand the pathway, or they're asking us to amend the pathway, challenging the evidence behind the pathway to make it work for their patients. So I really could go on because it's a bit of a passion for me around the program. But yeah, in a nutshell, that's how I see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can hear your passion for the subject, Joe, and I do know that you have another passion as well, football.
Oh, yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, how did you get into football?
Oh, I don't want to bore you in the background, but I played football when, as you would at school, and I was, at that time, I was scouted and playing for my local school, Kutama College in Zimbabwe. We played, you know, like the national football champ, you know, like a youth league. And I played well. So I got scouted by a Premier League team there called Dynamos. So I ended up playing in their junior team, then in their reserves. And that started my passion for football. But before I could really make big strides and, you know, with this team, I came to England and I still had that passion to play football. I played for the university, I played for some local teams. But again, life got in the way and, you know, university. So I didn't exploit my potential, so to say, but I still wanted to give back So I went into coaching. I've got my level two FA qualification. I'll hopefully very soon I'll be doing my what they call UFAB, which is quite a higher level of coaching. And I'm a director at North Riding FA. As one of the directors, I'm a director for health and well-being. So you can see it combines my health passion and working in football, which I just think is just, it's got a global appeal. And for me, from a public health perspective, how else better can I get people to be more active than playing the game I like? You know, and to be fair, even Ericsson, you know, the Danish player who had a cardiac arrest last year when
I remember,
it helped me actually refocus that to say, actually, this is an opportunity. As much as it was said for everyone who witnessed it, it's an opportunity to promote health through football. And imagine people like, or players like him, they get checked every day. They've got all the health access close to them. But what about the person who plays football in Northumberland, who is playing for the grassroots football, who doesn't get that? So it is an opportunity for me just to say, look after your health, know your numbers, but also play football. Yeah, but football is my passion. And unfortunately, my son, for his sins, is playing in a football academy and he's doing all right.
Brilliant. Brilliant. He's chip off the old block, is he then, Joe?
He always says he's better than me, so I can't.
I mean, I think that, you know, it's really interesting hearing you talk about that, Joe. And, you know, at the end of the day, this programme, the national programme, you know, started in October 2020, goes through to October 23. It's 3 years, which isn't very long. What do you think you would, or what would you like to see as the lasting legacy of this work?
It is a very good question. The legacy, I think, it's the adoption and spread and use of the pathway per se. But I think we can push all we like in the program until 2023 in terms of we need wider adoption. It's more about the system. It's the resilience within the system. We cannot ignore. We have had, for example, PTF pilot projects pushing up some rapid uptake products within the pathway. We've had some success on that, but we've had a lot of learning. So for me, the legacy is to take all that learning from the parts of the program which we have been delivering and to put into to good use. So one of it is, for example, capacity building. We've had the Tackling Cholesterol Together education program, which I know Sue Critchley, one of my associates, worked on. And I think it's one of those legacy part of the program to say, we understand there's a workforce issue. Every year or every other year, we've got maybe 10, 15 clinicians coming into the system in our networks. Are they aware of what the pathway is about? Can they access educational sessions which are tailored for whatever they would want within the pathway, whether it's particular drug interactions or public health promotions or signposting to services? So to us, when we stop to say the program is finished, that is the legacy when those really important, interventions we've introduced throughout the program are actually continuing to go on. So training is part of it, but also I think there's no turning back around the fact that one person dies every 3 minutes to me because of cardiovascular disease. So in this interview or in this discussion we've got here, one person dies because of cardiovascular disease. So for us, let's reduce that statistic. That's someone's mom, that's someone's brother, sister, whoever it might be. And we do know conditions like FH, for example, as much as it's 1 in 250 people have got FH, it is actually quite common and is under-detected. So the more we detect those people who need the treatment early, whether that's child through child parent screening or that adult who opportunistically walked into a GP practice and got diagnosed for FH, we're not just saving the NHS money in terms of treatment outcomes later down the year. We are actually saving lives and actually reinvesting in the community, or so to say, into the working population, because a lot of these working age people will be debilitated with these conditions. Yeah. they can't work for themselves. They want to contribute to the economy. So to me, the legacy goes beyond just the treatment side or identification. It's about what, you know, we bring to the local economy as well, because it's not about living longer. It's about probably living longer and healthier lives rather than, you know, in long-term conditions.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Joe, I'll leave it there. And thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much. It has rolled back the years. And I remember a few times when we sat in Teesside talking about AF.
Yeah, you know, that's right.
Whoever knew that, fast forward down this line, we'll be just have a candid conversation about that journey. So thank you so much for spending this time and having a discussion with you.
Thank you for listening to the Innovation in Healthcare podcast, produced by the Academic Health Science Network for the North East and North Cumbria. If you'd like to find out more about Joe Chidinika and our CVD programme, please visit the Improving Population Health section on our website at ahsn-nenc.org.uk. We will, of course, provide all the relevant links in this episode's show notes. Thank you again for listening.